So, where are we? Cal's not here, so someone has to pick up the sarcasm flag. What's that, Jesse? The eighth chapter of? Nehemiah. Okay. That is, in fact, exactly where we are, in addition to being in church. We are in Nehemiah chapter 8. Anybody remember the last thing we talked about from Nehemiah 8? Anyone?
Oh, my batteries are failing.
Oh, man.
Okay, what verse does that take place in? Thanks, Bob.
What chapter?
Nehemiah chapter 8. Pages 25 and 26.
25 and 26 in the book. Those pages. So we're in Nehemiah chapter 8. Right around verse 9, right? So the verse we ended with was kind of verse 8, right? And we sort of tapped into a little bit verses 9 through 12. But what happens is Nehemiah has, at this point, where are they in the city? Does anybody remember where they are?
The square.
AA, these guys. Thanks. The square before which gate? The water gate. I got it. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate it. They are in the square in front of the water gate, which... that area right there. The area that you see on the right. That's, as you can see, the water gate is labeled. They're in the square in front of the water gate, so there they are. Possibly the area on the left, not sure, but the area on the right was a very large open area, part of the city, so it's probably there. And we have power. Good. So, they're in the square in front of the water gate. And when do they start this reading of the law? In the morning? When in the morning? Early in the morning. In other words, when I still like to be asleep. Mom can attest, there were many, many days when I was a teenager, which I did not wake up until 11 or 12, or maybe 1, because I was up really late playing video games. So they're there in the water gate. They start early in the morning, and how late do they read the law? How late does this go? Till midday, till noon, right? And when the law is read, first of all, how is the law read? Is the law, first of all, who's doing the reading? And he's a scribe, and he is a what? He's a priest, right? He's a scribe, and he is a priest. He is not the high priest, but he's one of the more vocal priests. He's one of the more notable. And so here he is. He's reading the law. Now, he's up on a platform, right? And they have erected a special platform for the purpose. He's up on this platform. He's reading the law. But as he reads from the law, the way it's written, at least in Hebrew and also in Greek in the Septuagint, is that he reads sections of the law at a time. He doesn't just read it all the way through nonstop. He reads sections of the law at a time. Now, interspersed throughout the crowd, who else is there? Other priests, right? And so the way this actually is written in Nehemiah chapter 8 is that Ezra gets up and he reads a section of the law. And after he reads a section of the law, what happens? The priests have small crowds of people gathered around them while the priests begin to explain what that section of the law means and how the people should apply it, what's behind it, what principles God wants the people to understand about how they should behave, about how they should act. And so Ezra is reading, and I'm assuming Ezra stops to explain to the crowd that's around him because Scripture says he does. But as he's explaining to the crowd around him, the other priests are explaining to the crowd, to the section of the crowd that they have by them. And then when that explanation is done, Ezra reads from another section of the law. And then the explanation happens. And so the English Standard Version translates Nehemiah chapter 8, verse 8 this way: they read from the book from the law of God clearly, and they gave the sense so that the people understood the reading. Now, if you have other translations, might read with interpretation, or paragraph by paragraph, or verse by verse, or section by section. That's where we get this understanding that it was in piecemeal, right? Which is why it takes a long time. First of all, there are 600, well, by the Jewish count, there are either 613 or 614 individual commandments within the law of Moses. It depends on whether you count one of the commandments as two commandments or one commandment. Now, the problem with this, looking at it in such a rigid way, is that a lot of the commandments were hypotheticals. Here's how this kind of situation should be treated. The law of Moses was actually never meant to be exhaustive. It was meant to give guidelines on how a society should behave, how people should treat each other. So it throws out hypotheticals to give people precedent, principle, and understanding of how to deal with certain cases and certain issues. So it's actually not exhaustive. If this kind of thing happens, here's how you deal with it, right? Which means if this kind of thing happens, well, what if this thing happened and it's never covered in the law? Well, what's the closest thing you can find in the law? That'll give you an understanding of how to deal with this, right? So, but they read through the law, all the commandments. And when we talk about reading through the law, may very well include excerpts or the entirety of Genesis through Deuteronomy. That's a hefty task, right? But they do this. And while Ezra and the other priests, while Ezra's reading through it and the other priests are explaining it, how did the people begin to respond? They weep. Why? Because they understood. Right? What did they understand, though? They were convicted. Convicted of what? They were convicted of their own disobedience. Right? And not just their own disobedience, but what else? Forgetting law. But here's the thing. Why are they even, first of all, what position are they in right now, the people of Judah? What position are they in? How many tribes of the 12 are left?
Three.
What are they? Yeah, everybody always forgets the Levites, huh? Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. With a small pockets of the other 10 here and there who had fled to Judah at one point or another, either when Jeroboam first set up the northern kingdom or when the Assyrians marched in and some of them fled south for refuge there. At various points, some people from the northern tribes have migrated south for protection and safety. So you find small scatterings of individuals from other tribes, but the tribes as a whole are gone. So there's only three tribes that are left that are relatively intact. How did that come to pass? How did it come to be that only three tribes were left intact? The Assyrians, right? Well, why did the Assyrians happen to the northern kingdom? God, well, why did God allow it? Okay, so part of the blessings and curses of the covenant, Deuteronomy, right? So you've got that. But then this other thing that's happened to Judah is, who's ruling over Judah? The governor, who is? Nehemiah, at this point. Nehemiah is the governor. Now, Zerubbabel is dead, actually. So you've got Nehemiah, who is now the governor. But is Nehemiah independent? Does he operate on his own, or is he? Does he have someone that he has to answer to? He answers to Susa, right? He answers to Artaxerxes, right? He answers to the emperor. So, is Judah independent? Is it on its own? Is it a sovereign nation? No, it's a province. It's a conquered province, right? It is not a sovereign nation. So how do they get in this position? Okay, so when the crowd at the Watergate hears the law, they're convicted not only of their own sin, but what else? The sins of their forefathers. And they as Elmore said, they understood. They understand. And so what do they understand?
Well, it makes reference on Second Kings chapter 22.
Yeah. Yeah, what they understand is, we'll get to Josiah and the connection in just a minute. They understand why they are where they are. Right? That's what they understand. Theodore Roosevelt said, "He who does not know history is doomed to repeat it." If I may amend the phrase, he who does not understand history is doomed to repeat it. Because the Pharisees knew all this history, they just didn't understand it, which is why they repeated it. But this generation begins to understand their own history, why they are where they are. And that is what motivates them to weep and to mourn, to shed tears over this, because they really get it. And they have this sort of watershed, they have a watershed moment at the Watergate. And that motivates what happens in chapter 9. We'll look at that in just a little bit, chapters 9 and 10. But it's something that's very powerful. For the second time, a whole generation of God's people gets it. I mean, the first generation of God's people that really got it was the Joshua generation. And so now this generation under Nehemiah really gets it. I mean, we've got this sort of, it began under Zerubbabel, but it really culminates under Nehemiah. This group of Israelites finally gets all of it. Mom, and then Elmore again. Mom? Yeah.
So, to put it very simply.
Yeah. And there's a connection, like Elmore said, with Josiah. You want to go ahead and dig into that?
Well, first off, there's no excuse for them. And in some ways, when we started the book of Daniel, because they have the archives to look into for references of the king with the kings.
He found the book of the law, which is distressing in and of itself, because that shows us the book of the law had been allowed to become lost, right? So here you've got this generation that's once again reconnecting with who they're supposed to be, with the cornerstone of their identity, right, as God's people. And so here's where that connects with the sermon that I did last week, right? And I was trying to get into the back end of chapter Nehemiah chapter 8 last week, but we didn't have time. That's okay. But last week, my sermon was from Deuteronomy 16, right? And how many of us remember what that chapter's about? Okay, there we go. How many of us remember what Deuteronomy 16 is about? It's my sermon last Sunday morning.
It's about remembering who you are.
Right. That's the point of the sermon, right? So, all right, we remember the point of the sermon, remembering our identity, right? So how do we remember our identity? Yay, Kennedy. Awesome. Thanks.
Holidays
help us remember. Holidays help us remember, right? Our national identity as Americans is commemorated primarily through two holidays, 4th of July and Thanksgiving, right? Those are our two origin story holidays. Now, Israel has three origin story holidays. What are they? Passover, the Feast of Weeks, which is also called Pentecost, and then the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tents, or the Feast of Tabernacles, right? So, what does Passover celebrate? Freedom from slavery, right? Leaving the land of Egypt, that's all part of it. But if you look at the instructions that happen in Exodus 12, you shall say to your son when he comes of age, and when he asks you, what is the meaning of this sacrifice? What is the meaning of this land? What is the meaning of these commandments that the Lord our God has given us, right? You shall say to him, we do these, we observe these things because the Lord our God brought us up out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery, right? So Passover is about freedom from slavery. Leaving Egypt is a part of it, but it's at its core, it is about freedom from slavery. Okay? What is the feast? What is Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks, about?
50 days after the Passover.
Okay, that's the timing.
The home God gave to them.
The home God gave to them. It was the early harvest feast, right? There were two harvest feasts in the year, right? There was one, the early harvest feast, where you harvested your winter crops, and then there's the later harvest feast, where you harvest the summer crops. That happens in the fall. Now, Pentecost was the early harvest feast, where you harvest the winter and spring crops. So that's the early harvest feast. Now, the early harvest feast happened after Passover, and it celebrated the home they got. Remember when Moses spoke to Israel on behalf of God in the book of Deuteronomy and all throughout the 40 years of wandering? He said, when you come into the land that God is giving you to possess it, you will live in houses that what? Louder. You will live in the houses that you did not build. You will gather crops that you did not sow. Right? But they had houses. They had crops. And when they harvested the crops in Canaan, what did they get to do with those crops? They got to keep it. I mean, after they give the first fruits to God, right? You get to keep it. When had the Israelites ever gotten to keep a harvest before in their entire history? Never. Because even before they were slaves in Egypt, when they were free, they were still shepherds. They weren't farmers. And even before that, they were desert Bedouins before they went to Egypt. So they never got to keep a harvest for themselves in their entire history. This is the first time they get to do it. And when you get to keep the fruit of your own labor, that's what you call home, right? So Passover is about leaving, about freedom from slavery. Pentecost is about God giving them a home. Something else you want to say, Elmore?
When you mentioned about the building homes and plants, Jeremiah talks about that on Jeremiah 24.
Yeah.
The root figs and the bad figs were the one that stays in Judah. But the one that would take the exile, he said to make plant and marry and plant your, make houses and plant your vegetables.
Because this is your home for the next 70 years, right? But after 70 years, you'll get to go back home. And Jeremiah deals with that, too, even before this, because he buys a field, right? Because he's telling everybody land will be bought and sold here once again, right? So there's that. So Passover, freedom from slavery. Pentecost, God giving them a home. What is the Feast of Tents all about? How God cared for them in between those two things. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. What happened to their clothes? They didn't get holes. How many wives would love for their husband's clothing never to get holes again? How many men would love for our clothing never to get holes again? That way our wives wouldn't throw it out. And all you ladies are laughing because you've thrown out some of your husband's clothes that he has dug out for after you've thrown them out because, well, I like this shirt, but it's got holes in it. I don't care. What happened to their sandals? They didn't wear out. How do they eat?
Manna.
Manna. They went out and they gathered manna. And if you're going to translate manna from Hebrew to English, I mean, it has sort of a transliteration, right? But the best way to actually translate is whatchamacallit. Because manhu means what is this, right? It's whatchamacallit. So they went out and they gathered whatchamacallit every morning, except on Friday they gathered twice as much, right? So God fed them with manna. What else did he feed them with when they whined about manna? Quail. And how did they get water? Water from the rock on two different occasions, right? Another occasion he made poisonous water purified. On other occasions, he led them to amazing large oases with pools large enough for every tribe to come and drink. And what? And their animals. So, the Feast of Tents celebrates God providing for them in between. So these three festivals together remind them of who they are. Now, Passover had flagged a lot, right? It had fallen out of use, it had fallen out of practice, or when it was being practiced, it wasn't being practiced like it should be. Who was the king who finally got Passover right?
Josiah.
In what year of his reign did it happen? 18th. In the 18th year of Josiah's reign, they celebrated Passover. And it was the best Passover since who? 2 Kings 22, right? In the 18th year of his reign, it was the best Passover since who had been around? In 2 Kings 22, it says there had not been celebrated a Passover like it since the days of Samuel the prophet. Okay, so 22 is when he becomes king. 23 is when he restores the Passover. Okay, so in 2 Kings 22, it says since the days of the judges. I believe it's the 2 Chronicles account that says since the days of Samuel the prophet. The book of the law found. Josiah keeps the Passover. Yeah?
2 Kings 23 on verse 21. Read that.
Okay, 2 Kings 23, 21. Yeah. So, for Noah's Passover, verse 22, had been kept since the days of the judges who ruled Israel during all the days of the kings of Israel. Or the kings of Judah, right? I believe it's the 2 Chronicles account that says since the days of Josiah the king, or since the days of Samuel the prophet. Second Chronicles chapter 35, verse 18. No Passover like it had been kept in Israel since the days of Samuel the prophet. None of the kings of Israel had kept such a Passover as was kept by Josiah, and the priests and the Levites and all Judah and Israel who were present and the inhabitants of Jerusalem in the 18th year of the reign of Josiah, this Passover was kept. So none of the judges. And the 2 Kings account is probably saying since even during the time of the judges, this was never done this way. Right? None of the judges ever did it. None of the kings of Israel, none of the kings of Judah. Nobody had done it like Josiah had done it except for Samuel the prophet. That was the last time. Well, when Samuel is sort of the last of the judges, right? So since the time of the judges, since the time of Samuel. There we go. Saul is anointed in 1050. He becomes king. So we're talking before 1050. And Josiah is mid-600s. So let's get Josiah becomes king in 639. So the 18th year of his reign is 621. So for 429 years plus, no one had celebrated the Passover like Josiah. At least 429 years. That's the absolute minimum. At least 429 years. Now, how long has America been an independent nation? By our own reckoning. Because when do we count the origin of our nation? When do we say we became an independent nation? Why 1776? Louder, guys, louder. Declaration of Independence was published on July 4th, 1776, right? It was signed over a period of actually 2.5 or so months before that. Because that painting that we always see of all the men signing, right, is a total lie, by the way. It's a total lie because all of the signatories for the Declaration of Independence were heavily involved in the war. And they were rushing in and out of Philadelphia trying to make the war happen, carrying on the business of the Continental Congress and trying to supply the army with merchants here in the colonies. And so they were rushing in and out of the capital, which at the time was Philadelphia. And they were signing it as they could. So you see like two or three guys sign it one day and then a week goes by, nobody signed it, right? But they sign it in ones or twos or threes or fours or fives until everybody has finished signing it on July 2nd or July 3rd. And so they publish it on July 4th, right? So we say our Independence Day is July 4th. That's how long we've been a nation, since July 4th, 1776. Now, do you guys know what the English say about how long we've been an independent nation? They say since 1783. You want to know why they say since 1783?
Yorktown.
Yorktown, that's when General Cornwallis surrendered to General Washington. 1783, the Battle of Yorktown, the last battle of the war. That's when Cornwallis surrendered his sword. So, how long have we been an independent nation by our reckoning? Almost 241 years. 241 years this July 4th. The English say slightly less. But either way you cut it, that's longer than we have been a nation. The length of time in which they didn't celebrate the Passover. So, you've got the Passover had flagged. Now, I'd like to think that it kept on going. At least we know it kept on going during the reign of Josiah. Right? But the other kings we're not so sure about. What about Pentecost? Do we ever have a record of that ever being celebrated in the Old Testament? Hezekiah did, but he didn't do it like Josiah did. Passover had flagged and waned. It had waxed and it had waned in its practice. I mean, certain kings brought it and tried to bring it back and make it a big thing. Hezekiah certainly did, but nobody did it like Josiah did it. Not since Samuel, right? So as far as the observance of the Passover is concerned, Josiah stands head and shoulders above the rest because Scripture says he does. Although Hezekiah, among others, did restore the practice of the Passover. But I cannot find any account of the Feast of Weeks of Pentecost being observed in the Old Testament. I do not remember any off the top of my head, I will say that. If you can find one, please let me know, because I don't remember of any episode where the Feast of Weeks was practiced in the Passover, after Joshua. I don't remember of any. Like I said, I could be wrong. If you find some, let me know. But it's the late harvest feast now in Nehemiah, right? And so Passover and Pentecost are both earlier in the year. But this is happening later in the year. And so because it's happening later in the year, Nehemiah takes this opportunity to reconnect the people with who they are. I mean, they've reconnected themselves with the law, with the way of life that they should have, with how they should be treating each other. But what Nehemiah needs to do now is he needs to reinstill in them why they do these things. And that comes by remembering who they are. So how does Nehemiah get them to remember who they are and to impress upon them the reason for following the law? What's that, Alexia? He tells them the history. That happens in chapter 9, right? But what's the back end of chapter 8 about? That's the front end of chapter 8. What's the back end of chapter 8? Why did I just talk about holidays, guys? The reading didn't start Passover. It wasn't Passover that started. It was Sukkot, the Feast of Tents, the Feast of Booths, the Feast of Tabernacles. The Hebrew word for it is Sukkot. It was Sukkot. It was the Feast of Tents. It wasn't Passover. That's earlier in the year. This is the Feast of Tents. And the reading of the law kicked off their celebration of the Feast of Tents. He got them all together. He had them read and he had them understand. And then he said, okay, we're going to do it. We're going to put it back into practice. Yeah? Nehemiah chapter 8, verses 13 and 14. On the second day, this is the day after the reading of the law, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people with the priests and the Levites came together to Ezra the scribe in order to study the words of the law. So after the law is read publicly, the leaders of the city and the heads of the households, the leaders of the clans come together and they say, we want to know more. Which tells you this generation is getting it right. Right? Verse 14, they found it written in the law that the Lord had commanded by Moses that the people of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month, and that they should proclaim it and publish it in all their towns in Jerusalem, go out into the hills and bring branches of olives, wild olive, myrtle, palm, and other leafy trees to make tents, to make booths, as it is written. So the people went out and brought them and made booths for themselves, each on his own roof, in the courts of the house of God, and in the square at the water gate, and in the square of the gate of Ephraim. And all the assembly of those who had returned from the captivity made booths and lived in the booths, for from the days of Jeshua, the son of Nun. Who is that? Remember, Jeshua. What name is that? Joshua. What name is it also? Jesus, right? Why is it Jeshua here? Why is it Joshua in Joshua and in Exodus and in the law? And why is it Jesus in the New Testament? Translation. Transcribing, right? In Greek, the name is Jesus, which is why we get Jesus, right? Because the Hebrews Hellenized their names for Greek writing. For example, to show the way Hebrews dealt with their own names when they were writing in Greek, right? When we say Hellenized, what we mean is to make that Greek, because Hellas was one of the ancient names for Greece as a whole. So Hellenized means Hellas. Hellenistic Jews means Jews who are culturally Greek. That's what you get, which is why they're called Hellenistic, Hellas, Greeks. So, if a Jew was writing Yaakov in Greek, he would write it Yaakovos. which the name James that we have is actually Jacob. It's actually Yakobos in Greek. It's Jacob. James is Jacob. In Greek, they write Iesus, which is sort of a Hellenization of the Aramaic Yeshua, and the Hebrew Yehoshua. So through a long, complex translation issue of Hebrew doesn't have vowels, and so sometimes people got the vowels a little bit mistaken until we knew more about how the language worked. You get names like Joshua as opposed to Jeshua here, or Yeshua in Aramaic, Yehoshua Hebrew, Jesus Greek, Jesus. This is all the same name. It's the same consonants in Hebrew, and if you look at one and you look at the other, there is no difference. It is exactly the same name. So Jeshua, son of Nun, Joshua, son of Nun. Who is Joshua, son of Nun? Anyone?
Jesus.
Well, Jesus, yeah, that's his name. But who is Joshua, son of Nun? The Joshua. The Joshua of the conquest. Joshua, since the days of Joshua, son of Nun. So, again, that's Nehemiah chapter 8. For from the days of Joshua, I'll get you just a second, Elmore. The back end of verse 17, Nehemiah chapter 8. For from the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, to that day, the people of Israel had not done so. And there was great rejoicing. And day by day, from the first day to the last day, he read from the book of the law of God. And they kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth day there was a solemn assembly according to the rule. Yeah?
I propose this feast did not start on the second day.
Okay.
The law was read on the first day of the seventh month, of this month.
Yeah.
Okay, the seventh month. Then it says in verse 13, on the second day, the heads of the fathers of the houses, that all the people with the priests and Levites came together to Ezra and Zechariah in order to study.
Yeah.
Then, after that, they built the booths.
It kicks off their observance of the feast.
Right, but I don't think that 7 days of feasting started on that second day. I think more
okay.
likely they started on the 15th day because...
That's when it says in the law, 15th day. Okay.
Law.
Yeah. So what I...
Really sorrowful.
Okay. So what I mean when I say it kicks it off and on the second day they start... Okay. The actual technical observance of the feast doesn't start until the 15th. But in order to properly observe the feast, they had to make a lot of preparation. They had to send the notice throughout the whole land. They had to gather all the materials required. They had to build these temporary shelters. Okay? So when I say they started their observance on the second, what I mean by that, and what it, nitpicking and splitting hairs, which is, let me finish. Let me finish, please. It is significant, right? But the same thing is happening with Jesus around the time of his crucifixion. Because one of the Gospels says the meal they ate in the upper room was part of was the Passover, right? One of the other Gospels says it wasn't the Passover yet. Which one's right? They're both right, okay? Because the meal that they had was sort of a side effect, a result of getting all the leaven out of the house like they were supposed to, right? So the meal that they had and all the preparation that they did, there was like 2 weeks of preparation that went into observing the Passover, if you're going to do it right, at least. So when you have a wedding, right? What do you do when you have a wedding? You got planning, right? Yes, Cal said you got to spend money. Yep. You got planning, right? Your wedding, you got to pick out cake, you got to get a baker, right? You got to get a dress, right? I mean, this is all the parts of a wedding, right? But they're not the part of the wedding. Because the wedding is only that one event, but they're all part of the wedding, right? You got the rehearsal dinner, which is a part of the wedding. But it's not technically a part of the wedding, but it's still part of a wedding. So when I say the reading of the law kicked off their observance of the Feast of Booths, that on the second day they started it, on the second day they began their preparation. On the second day, they started making all the moves that were required to actually keep this feast the way they were supposed to do it. And you can even say the first day really kicked it off, because that's when they started reading the law, and that's what whetted the appetite of the leaders of Judah to know more, which is what led to them discovering the Feast of Booths in the first place, which is what led to them observing the Feast of making the preparations and observing the Feast of Booths in the first place. So, yes, technically, the feast technically begins on the 15th day of the seventh month, but all the preparation that's necessary for the feast happens before that. And so when I say that the reading of the law and they're coming to Ezra, the priest, and the other Ezra and the rest of the priests to learn more about the law began that, it began that process, which I don't think is an inaccurate statement, because that's certainly the way Nehemiah chapter 8 represents it, right? Is that the reading of the law whetted the appetite of the leaders, and so they went to the priests and they said, we want to know more, and they find this and they say, okay, we need to do this, right? So technically, yes, it begins on the 15th day of the seventh month. But all the preparation that needs to happen starts because of this morning on the first day of the seventh month where Ezra and the other priests read the law. And so it kicks forward from there. The ball is put in play on that day, right? But the game doesn't start until the 15th. So does that make sense to everybody? At least what I'm saying? Kind of. All right. So what they do, what? Yes? No? Not really? Elmore? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But anyways, what I wanted to point out is on Nehemiah chapter 8, can we go back up on...
No, certainly not. Yeah. Yeah.
There was that emotion. They were instructed by Nehemiah and Ezra, the priest and the scribes, that they would have that they shouldn't be sad. They should be happy.
We did talk about this last week, right? When they do start to mourn, when they do start to weep, I remember us addressing it last week at least. What Nehemiah and the other leader said, Elmore's exactly correct, is don't mourn. This day is holy to the Lord. This is a day of rejoicing, right? Because and I think what Elmore's getting, you could say it. I won't put words in your mouth. Yeah, and when Nehemiah and the priests lay this charge on the people not to mourn, to be happy, to rejoice instead. I mean, what we've got is we've got two things going on. The people are convicted of their sin, right? And they understand the sins of their fathers that led them to where they are now. But one of the things that Nehemiah is also saying is, look, yes, problems led to this, but you have an opportunity here in front of you. You've got an opportunity to get it right. What you've just had the law read to you in a way that your fathers did not. And that should be a cause for celebration. That should be a cause for joy, because now you've got something to work for. You have a goal that your fathers didn't possess. And so live understanding that goal and where it comes from and how you should be working for it, and celebrate this. Celebrate today. Instead of allowing it to be a cause of mourning, celebrate today, because now you finally know who you are again. And even though sadness comes along with that, that's a cause for joy, because now you remember where you're supposed to be. And your feet have been put back on the right path, right? That there's something positive that this should come out of this. And so in chapter 9, when the Feast of Booths is over, right? When this is finished, what do the people do in chapter 9? They confess their sins, right? But not only do they confess, they go through a history of their own people, right? They go through a long history of who they are. And they start in Egypt. And they tell their story, right? Which is fitting at this moment, right? Because they had the law read to them, which led to them observing this holiday, which is one of their national origin story holidays, right? And so here they've just come off of this great high, and here they are, and they're in this headspace now, and they say, we need to make sure this never happens again, so we need to remember, we need to make sure we'll always remember who we are. And so they gather together, and they tell their story. After observing one of the holidays that's so integral to understanding this story, they tell the whole story. They start with Moses in Egypt and the slavery. And they walk through the Exodus. They walk through Joshua. They walk through the judges. They walk through the kings, the United Kingdom. They walk through the division of the kingdom. They walk through the Assyrian annihilation. It's not a decimation. It's an annihilation of the northern kingdom. They walk through the period of independence that Judah has and the failure of most of those kings, and then walk through the Babylonian captivity, and they walk through their own restoration. They walk through the return from exile. And they tell the story of all of these things. And they say, this is why we're here. And throughout all of these episodes in their history, what is the one common factor? What's the common denominator? In all of these periods of their history, what one thing has always happened? Punishment. Why? Disobedience. They did not listen to your words and they rejected your prophets. They did not listen to your words and they rejected your prophets. Those are the words the ESV uses. They did not listen to your words and they rejected your prophets. That phrase appears over and over throughout this section. They did not listen to your words and they rejected your prophets. Stiff-necked and rebellious, right? Which is, those are the exact words that God uses himself in the book of Exodus and in the book of Numbers. They are a stiff-necked and rebellious people. They are stiff-necked and rebellious, right? They did not listen to your words and they rejected your prophets. So, they were disobedient in verse 25. They were disobedient, rebelled against you, cast your law behind their back, and killed your prophets who had warned them in order to turn them back to you, and they committed great blasphemies. And this is the section that leads into the Babylonian captivity, right there from verse 25 on. And so what they do is they reaffirm the covenant. They go back to Exodus 19, they go back to Deuteronomy, and they write the words of the covenant again. And this time, what do they do with the words of the covenant? They have the record of the covenant. God has already signed on to the covenant, and his faithfulness to the covenant is evident throughout their national history. What do they do now with this record of the covenant? Was that Kennedy? They sign their own names to it, right? Well, a covenant is a promise. A covenant is a contract, and it's an agreement. God had already sworn his end of the covenant before. What they're doing is they're renewing the covenant. They are promising once again to keep up their end of the covenant. They are renewing the covenant themselves personally. This is not quite as grandiose as what happened on the side of the mountain in Exodus 24, but this is this generation doing the same thing. Well, it's a pledge to keep up their end of the covenant, right? I mean, that's what this is. And if we look at, I believe the language itself uses the word covenant. And yeah. Verse 38 in the ESV says, because of all this, we make a firm covenant in writing. On the sealed document are the names of our princes, our Levites, and our priests. So the entire, both political and religious leadership cast of Judah put their names to this. They all make this covenant anew. They rededicate themselves and the nation by proxy to keeping this, to not making the same mistakes. So, in chapter 10, what we see is we see a record, right, of the people in the first few verses. First 27 verses, but all the first 27 verses are really short. They're just a list of names. And about verse 28, we see the people reiterating the important aspects of it, right? These are the keystone things that we have to do to maintain the covenant, right? These are the important things that we have to do. We need to make sure the Sabbath is kept holy. That's one of the things that's listed. We will not give our daughters to the peoples of the land or take their daughters for our sons, verse 30. Verse 31, 30 is about maintaining the Sabbath. In verse 29, they talk about keeping all the laws that and the commandments that the Lord that Yahweh, our Lord, has given us in all His rules and His statutes. They make sure to provide for the maintenance of the temple, the Levites and the priests in the following verses. And to maintain the priesthood, not just financially, but ethically, spiritually, morally, make sure the priesthood is what it should be. And this is an important part because, first of all, what is a covenant? It's an agreement, right? It's a contract. What function do the priests serve within this within a covenant? What's their contractual service?
Mediators.
They're the mediators of the covenant. They're the arbitrators, right? The covenant is actually built on the backs of the priests. The priests are the ones who maintain the covenant. They're the ones who make sure the covenant stays enforced. That's the function of the priests, which is why the priests are required to teach the law, which is why the priests are required to be the ones to intercede for the people and offer sacrifices, right? The priesthood comes first, and then the covenant. Now, the Mosaic covenant was sort of interesting and kind of an isolated case because the priesthood was not identified until later. The covenant came first. That was Exodus 19. When was the priesthood identified? When was the priestly tribe selected? Nobody remembers, huh? What sanctifies?
Blood.
Blood sanctifies. First of all, what was the liturgical tribe? What was the priestly tribe?
Levi.
What sanctified Levi for the priesthood?
They killed their brothers.
The blood of their own people. When did the Levites shed the blood of their own people?
After Mount Sinai.
What happened in Mount Sinai?
Well, God was angry.
Why was he angry?
The golden calf.
The golden calf. When Moses came down from the mountain, the people had built an idol. Moses said, "Who is on the side of Yahweh?" And the Levites answered. And they went throughout the camp executing the people who were doing this. That is what showed their willingness to enforce the covenant. That is what proved that they were the tribe that was qualified to mediate because they were willing to enforce it under the harshest circumstances. That is what sanctified them. That is what made them worthy. That is what qualified them for the priestly service. And Aaron and his sons are picked after that moment. And from the implication, the connection to Aaron and the choosing of the tribe of Levi, I have to imagine that maybe Aaron's sons might have been some of the ones who rose up against their father and said, "Look, we can't have this." And I'm guessing. But that may have been Nadab and Abihu's shining moment where they said, "We can't have this." Might have been. We know at least Phinehas was like that too. Another one of Aaron's grandsons. Phinehas had that quality too in Numbers 26. So that's the moment at which they're picked. And so they have the restoration of the priesthood, the maintaining of the priesthood. is the one thing that's most necessary for maintaining the covenant. And whenever the covenant is violated, who does God blame first? He always blames the priests first. Always. He always blames the priests first. We see that in Hosea. We see that in Isaiah. We see that in Micah. We see that in Jeremiah. What kind of family did Jeremiah come from? A priestly family. If I remember correctly, he came from a priestly family. I believe his father was a priest. And so, Daniel was a noble, right? Jeremiah's father, I believe, was a priest, if I remember correctly. Zechariah's father was a priest. Zechariah himself was a priest. And so God always blames the priest first. And so Judah puts it in their mind, we're not going to let this happen again. What we have after that is a list of all the people who returned from exile and sort of a census of Judah from there. We have a dedication of the wall, the rededication of the service of the temple, the reorganization of the priests and the Levites into sort of the sectors of worship that they had been involved in, that David started, and in preparation for building the temple in Jerusalem, David sort of restructured the priesthood with the blessing of God through the prophet Nathan. Nathan told him, God is with you, do this, this is what God wants. So David does it. Hezekiah does it again. He rededicates the priesthood that way. And so now you find Nehemiah once again doing the same thing, arranging everything the way it's supposed to be, the way God had designed it for the temple service, the way David had done it. So we're going to stop here. We're going to look at the last chapter of Nehemiah next week, and that's going to bleed into Malachi as well. We're going to see some common threads between Nehemiah 13 and Malachi next week. That the problems that are in one chapter are a part of the problems in the other book. So we're going to do that, and then probably the week after that, we'll start our ending of the Old Testament with Daniel chapter 7 through 12, if we can get through Malachi in 1 week, which I think we can. And then we'll start the New Testament. And as I said before, I'm almost done with the New Testament, with the Harmony of the Synoptic Gospels material. So I'm hoping to have that for you next week, but at the very least I'll have it for you for the week after that at the absolute latest. So thank you everybody once again for your attendance and your participation. We are dismissed, and we'll have about a 15-minute break. And please remember, men of the congregation, to meet in the back to make Brother Cooper's job easier. Thank you everybody much once again, and we are finished.